today, how a little-known terror network hatched a plot that shook the world and then nearly destroyed them.
Pretty dramatic picture we're looking at right now. Fire in one of the World Trade Center towers in New York City. We don't know the cause of this fire or exactly where it's coming from, but it appears there has been an explosion.
Once you got over the shock that someone had flown planes into the Twin Towers, it was inevitably the next question. Who did this?
It's not known who was behind them, nor is it clear how many people have died or have been injured.
I think the intelligence community right now, especially the intelligence community, is taking a view of it looks like, but we're not totally sure yet.
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts.
For a very small group of people, it was obvious. I mean, September 11, 2001... How long does it take you to suspect Al-Qaeda might be involved?
Oh, immediately.
Right away?
Oh, right away.
Jason, where were you on September 11th, and how quickly did you suspect it could be the work of this group that you'd been tracking?
I was in the offices of The Observer, and I was standing next to Paul Webster, who is now the editor, and we were watching the screen showing the second plane flying into the second tower. And I turned to Paul and I said, that's Bin Laden.
To Jason Burke, a foreign correspondent with The Guardian and Observer, the identity of the masterminds wasn't a mystery at all. He had spent the past few years chasing their trail through Pakistani cities and the Afghan countryside. Ayman Dean knew a lot about Al-Qaeda too because, well, he was a member and then became a spy inside the group.
My mission was to try to identify as many cells, as many individuals, as many fundraisers.
The hijackings that killed nearly 3,000 people made Al-Qaeda infamous around the world. But for the group itself, the attack has been described as a catastrophic success. 9/11 drew Al-Qaeda's enemies into long, painful wars and inspired thousands of new jihadis. But it very nearly destroyed the terror group itself.
We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
20 years later, against all expectations, they're still here, but in a very different form. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, how Al-Qaeda survived the war on terror and what it looks like now. Ayman, let's start at the beginning of your path to becoming a jihadi. What kind of kid were you?
Nerd. I think that's the best way I can describe myself growing up. Very much into politics, theology, religion, history. You know, so yeah, I'm very typical nerd.
When did you first come to understand that you were involved in some kind of religious war?
First, there was a Bosnian war. The radical Saudi clerics. It wasn't so much a grooming, but it was more or less the indoctrination that we are at war with the cross. So they were telling us, if this is what they will do to people who are fellow Europeans, can you imagine what they will do to us?
It might have started as something a nerdy kid read in books, but pretty soon it became personal.
The fact that one of our teachers, he went to fight the jihad in Bosnia, and actually he died over the summer. And so when we came back to the school, he wasn't there anymore. We were asking, where is he? Like, I mean, we were told that he died in Bosnia. The Bosnian conflict wasn't just a faraway, you know, conflict in a forgotten corner of Europe. No, it's actually like, and it came all the way to our classroom. So this is when I started to think about going.
You lost your parents at quite a young age, and I hope you don't mind my asking, but was that a factor in your journey?
The loss of my dad happened when I was only 4 and a half. So for me, I grew up without a father figure. So for me, it fell to my mother. But then she passed away when I was 12. That loss was the loss of the moral compass that I had. And therefore, in my way of dealing with the grief, I ended up delving deeper and deeper into the, I would say, the radical interpretation of Islam as it was written by the Egyptian thinker Sayyid Qutb.
Qutb is sort of the intellectual godfather of jihadism. He was also a nerd. But he wrote books that cast the entire world as barbaric and said violence was permitted, necessary even, to bring it back to the faith.
If my mother didn't die, I wouldn't have read Sayyid Qutb. If I didn't read Sayyid Qutb, I wouldn't have gone into this kind of radical notion of God's kingdom on earth brought about by jihad. And I wouldn't have gone to Bosnia. Of course, my mother wouldn't have let me even, like, you know, I mean, you know, gone hunting, let alone going to Bosnia.
Oh, so that would have been the reason. Your mum wouldn't have let you go.
Yes, for sure.
You were still just a teenager when you actually put those beliefs into practice. You traveled to Bosnia, as you mentioned. Did that experience change your understanding of jihad?
Of course, like, I mean, it's very much different when you see the sea in front of you and then when you dip your feet into it and then you start swimming.
The Bosnian War was brutal, rife with war crimes. But for a generation of young jihadis, it was a proving ground. Ayman was only 16, but it hardened him and introduced him to new circles.
When the Bosnian Jihad was coming to an end, it was roughly around October of 95. I remember there I was at a wedding of one of the fellow jihadists. There at the wedding was a newly arrived individual who I didn't recognize at the beginning, but then they told me, like, you know, this man is Khalid Sheikh. In later life, he will be known as the mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Nonetheless, I mean, he was sitting and he was telling us about the changing nature of the war and that the Americans are the real enemies. And he kept going on and on about it. You know, I asked him, okay, you are telling us you want us to go to Afghanistan to get this training. How do we get there? And I remember, like, you know, he handed me a piece of paper. You know, he wrote himself very quickly. And on that paper, there was a name and a phone number. And he said, this man, he's in Peshawar. Whenever you make it there, just call this number. He will come and pick you up. Tell them it's me. I sent you.
Peshawar, on the Pakistani border with Afghanistan. A regular visitor to that city around the same time was a foreign correspondent for The Observer, Jason Burke. He was on a story that was getting a bit of attention, but which not a lot of people were tracing all the way to its roots.
For a Western journalist to move around Afghanistan in the late 90s was not really as dangerous as it sounds. I mean, there were long periods where I was the only Western journalist around, and you could move very slowly and in great discomfort on terrible roads, but virtually anywhere in a very poor, still quite violent, but very beautiful country.
You were chasing the trail of someone who was already, at that point, the most wanted man in the world. Osama bin Laden was the leader of a group of Arab Islamists, they called themselves Al-Qaeda, who had spent the past few years bouncing around the world, living like fugitives. But by the late 1990s, in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, bin Laden had found a kind of base. How important was that to him?
He was, for the first time, really kind of secure in his location. He had the space and the resources to really prosecute what he'd been thinking about for a long time.
Years ago, the Saudi businessman turned terrorist Osama bin Laden issued a new threat against Americans, a threat to
this international jihad against the far enemy. That's the enemy of the West, the US particularly, the Zionist Crusader Alliance, as he calls it, not the near enemy, which are the local regimes in Egypt or Jordan or Syria or Algeria or wherever.
ABC's John Miller recently traveled to Afghanistan for a rare interview with bin Laden.
We believe that the biggest thieves in the world are Americans, and the biggest terrorists on earth are the Americans.
Among jihadi groups, was what they were doing innovative?
What bin Laden does is that he senses that something is in the air in the late 1990s globally, and that is a massive wave of internationalization. There are a lot of things that are happening that are joining the world together in new ways, whether it be media, whether it be financial flows, whether it be immigration flows. And so bin Laden globalizes too. He's one of the very few Islamic militants who believes that that is what has to be done, that you have to strike what he calls the head of the snake, which is America. And that is new.
That's a very big ambition. What does he do in this stronghold he has to actually put it into action?
In that period, 1996 to 2001, he started to put together the strategy of the global jihad and found the resources. And one of the greatest resources that he found was that because he was in a safe place and could run training camps, people came to him. So he could gather together all the strands, factions, individuals with capabilities that he needed, bring them into Afghanistan or welcome them when they came, often of their own free will, turned up with ideas of projects that they wanted to complete, asking him for his help.
Ayman, when did you first meet Osama bin Laden?
So I heard, along with the others, that Osama bin Laden was looking to meet anyone who is from the Arabian Peninsula. So there were 14 of us crammed into one small pickup car. The compound was roughly about 45 minutes drive from where our training camp was. Well, first impression, they looked like refugees. He looked disheveled. There were bags and crates and boxes everywhere. Nonetheless, we sat down in front of him. He was asking us about our jihadi experience in Bosnia and what we're doing here. And of course, we asked him about his plans. And of course, he launched into Afghanistan will be the launch pad for the armies that will liberate the Arabian Peninsula and Jerusalem, you know, from the Crusaders and the Zionists. So he was saying, we might look like refugees now, but we can change the path of Islamic history.
In the next year, you swore allegiance to him. So he must have really impressed you. What was he like as a person?
Well, bin Laden as a person is someone who was, one, soft-spoken, second, reassuring and fatherly. His height made you feel, you know, well, he's there somewhere, like, you know, there in command. And at the same time, his soft features and soft demeanor and the ability to assure you that you're fine. I mean, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. Like, I mean, you're in the right place. Of course, I remember when I joined Al-Qaeda, I remember Osama bin Laden was looking at me and was saying, you are no commando material.
Was that a bit crushing to be told by Osama bin Laden that you're not commando material?
Oh, no, it was actually like a confirmation of something I already knew. I mean, so because what followed was something that made me really happy. You know, we are selecting you for something that is far more important, to train in Al-Qaeda's program for explosives, chemical weapons, biological weapons, poisons. That was more exciting.
Jason, as the late 90s go on, Al-Qaeda starts carrying out these attacks. What kind of things was it doing?
The first really big attack that Al-Qaeda pull off are the 1998 bombings of US embassies in Tanzania and Kenya.
Frankly, very angry. Very angry. It's inhuman, it's evil, it's despicable.
I mean, they kill upwards of 200 people, mainly locals, in fact. They devastate two embassies, basically destroy them. And that really puts them on the map.
These acts of terrorist violence are abhorrent. They are inhuman. We will use all the means at our disposal to bring those responsible to justice.
They then follow that up with a suicide boat, basically, alongside a US warship off Yemen, and blow a massive hole in the side, again cause substantial damage and significant casualties.
I want to express my deep sorrow at the explosion involving the US naval vessel Cole in Yemen.
And that is another really major blow that boosts the confidence of bin Laden and confirms to him that his strategy of striking the US is the right one to follow.
You have declared a jihad against the United States. Can you tell us why?
He gets a lot of media attention, and that is profoundly important to him. This is a time when satellite TV is rapidly expanding. He can talk in a much more direct way to the people he wants to reach. He does it with these videos that get shown, and he does it through spectacular acts of violence, propaganda by deed.
These mass casualty attacks were putting Al-Qaeda on the map, but not everyone in the organization was celebrating. Quietly, Ayman had started having doubts about whether those they were killing were really enemies of Islam.
I remember when that happened, heard on the radio about the casualties. I mean, I was really horrified that 12 Americans were killed, but in addition, 220 innocent Kenyans and other Africans were killed, as well as 5,000 people were wounded, 150 of them were blinded for life. You know, the figures were horrific. For me, I was thinking, well, that is what I've been trained on, and one day I will be going out to the world to cause this maximum damage to life. I was thinking at the time that I would be doing it against military installations, military facilities, that the casualties, and I would be crude here when saying it, I thought the casualties would be American service men. And that more or less convinced me that I'm the wrong place at the wrong time, and I wanted to leave. I ended up leaving 4 months after the attacks because that was the only opportune moment. But once I left, I found myself through many twists and turns, ended up working for the British intelligence services, MI5 and MI6.
Yeah, Ayman becomes a double agent inside Al-Qaeda. There's a lot of that he can't talk about, and a lot we don't have time to tell. But he's spying on the organization when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy who sent Ayman to Afghanistan in the first place, approaches bin Laden with plans for another attack. This one's on a completely different scale.
American 11, if you hear Boston Center, ident, please, or acknowledge.
He's more ambitious. He looks for something bigger.
American Airlines emergency line, please state your emergency.
Another militant who's not part of Al-Qaeda, called Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, comes to see him with a crazy plan for simultaneous hijackings of dozens of planes in East Asia and in the US at the same time.
I am monitoring a call in which Flight 11, the flight attendant is advising our reps that the pilot, everyone's been stabbed.
Flying them all around, doing press conferences, all those kind of things.
They were sitting in 2A and B. They are in the cockpit with the pilot.
He takes that plan, puts it aside, then comes back to it, says to himself, actually, this might work if we change things around a bit.
We contacted air traffic control. They are going to handle this as a confirmed hijacking.
So pairs the plan down, comes up with the idea for the 9/11 attacks.
767 departed Boston, going to LAX. We don't know where the aircraft is going.
Finds the recruits in the training camps that he's established in Afghanistan.
Well, Boston Center claims that they lost radio communication with the aircraft and the transponder.
Picks a team, puts it all in motion.
It looks like he's Middle Eastern, he speaks no English. He was in 10B, 10 Baker.
And it works.
Kennedy Tower reports that there was a fire at the World Trade Center. And that's the area where we lost the airplane.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack.
And on that day, Jason, September 11, how does Al-Qaeda receive word of the attack?
He had tasked one of his subordinates with setting up a kind of media van that was filled with bits of fairly rubbish media equipment, actually. A couple of satellite phones, some screens, radios. Anyway, it was pretty ramshackle, and unsurprisingly, it didn't actually work. So they were driving about, trying to get a signal to try and watch what was happening in the US. Failed. But they did get BBC radio. So they heard it over the radio, and they heard the news. The first plane hitting, then the second, and then what was happening with the third and fourth planes, then obviously they were jubilant. So that's how Bin Laden learned, and he felt thoroughly vindicated in his decision to go ahead with the attacks against the opposition of other members of his organization.
I'm kind of surprised to hear there were vocal opponents to these sorts of plans within Al-Qaeda. What were their objections?
There were a lot of people within Al-Qaeda who thought it was a really bad idea to attack America. They said America would respond, that America would invade, that they would lose the very useful safe haven with all the infrastructure that they'd managed to build up in Afghanistan, that they would be scattered, that they would no longer be able to plan, and that it would be a disaster, not just for Al-Qaeda, but for the whole Islamic extremist jihadi movement. Bin Laden, as he tended to do at the time, he listened to all the counter-arguments patiently and totally ignored them.
What did Bin Laden think would happen next after those attacks?
Well, Bin Laden was convinced that the Americans wouldn't respond, or certainly not respond in any great strength or with any great commitment. And he thought that because he'd already blown up two large embassies and nearly sunk a warship. The only thing that had happened was that US had fired off a few dozen cruise missiles at what were basically empty training camps. So he was convinced already the US was a paper tiger, if you like.
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
But there seems to be such an obvious difference between hitting a warship, foreign embassies, and striking the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, killing nearly 3,000 people, all of it live on TV.
USA! USA!
The idea that America wouldn't strike back hard just seems incredibly naive.
I don't think Bin Laden was necessarily basing his decision to go for 9/11 simply on what might happen afterwards. I'm not sure that was a major consideration for him. He felt this was something that he needed to do, he should do, and something that would advance in a very significant way his agenda of destabilizing the US, undermining the US support for what he saw as unbelieving, repressive, corrupt regimes in the Middle East, and would also provoke a massive wave of mobilization within the Islamic world in his favor.
I want him help. I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Bin Laden obviously miscalculated. The Americans invaded Afghanistan a few weeks later. And you were there, weren't you?
I was there right the way through, watching the Americans trying to catch Bin Laden at Tora Bora, which was a cave complex high up in the mountains where Bin Laden had hidden, and he thought he could kind of hold off the US and their local allies there. He was completely wrong, of course, and after being pummeled by massive bombing raids by B-52s and pretty much everything else the Americans could throw at him, he escaped by going north, up along the frontier of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then crossed over into Pakistan.
Al-Qaeda became the target of an unrelenting international manhunt. What happened to that space that Al-Qaeda had once enjoyed?
It's quite interesting reading some of the statements and letters, internal communications by senior Al-Qaeda leaders, even kind of poetry written by Bin Laden himself or by his children, all of which is full of this despair without homes, without security, with nowhere to live, surrounded by hostile elements, hunted. There are about 1,500 people kind of loosely associated with Al-Qaeda and various other Islamic militant groups in Afghanistan at the time. About 1,000, 1,200 were probably killed. The rest scattered into Iran, a lot into Pakistan. It was a massive blow. The general sense among kind of senior Al-Qaeda people was that we are really in deep, deep trouble now. And we don't even have a leader because nobody even knew where bin Laden was. He kind of went off the radar for a couple of years.
Part of the success authorities had in hunting Al-Qaeda was informants, like Ayman. He definitely wasn't commando material, but he was good with details. And now that quality was being turned against Al-Qaeda.
I would say that during my time there, you know, from 1998 all the way until 2006, this is how long I served with the UK intelligence services, I provided them with the entire program that Al-Qaeda created for explosive biological weapons, chemical weapons, and poisons. I also basically pinpointed every single training camp that I've been to or aware of. And also basically for them to provide me with pictures in which basically I can just, you know, put them on a board and I can say, like, you know, this is the name, this is the person, that's their position within the organization, that these are their immediate commanders, this is who they report to. So it was about providing a physical and structural picture of the group.
I know Ayman's story is extraordinary, but there's good reason to believe it's all true. He worked with two journalists on a book, Paul Cruikshank and Tim Lister, who say their own intelligence sources corroborated key parts of Ayman's story, and that he was, by far, the most important spy the West had inside Al-Qaeda. Jason, by 2003, you say Al-Qaeda is quite degraded, and then the US and its allies invade Iraq, and it provides a kind of spark for the organization. What does Al-Qaeda do there?
Iraq helps Al-Qaeda in loads of different ways. First thing it does is it diverts an awful lot of US attention and resources. It creates a massive wave of anger across the Islamic world and beyond, which helps recruitment.
The jihadis filmed their attack on Abu Ghraib prison and set it to music.
And when in Iraq a group forms that decides it wants to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq and reaches out to bin Laden saying, can we be Al-Qaeda in Iraq? It gives the parent group, which has suffered a lot, an opportunity to show a much greater reach, to expand into a whole new area, to have boots on the ground, if you like, actual fighters, to claim new attacks.
We turn overseas tonight into an ABC News exclusive. America's biggest enemy making its return tonight. And where? Iraq.
And to slowly start to rebuild some of the capacity that it had lost.
So Iraq allows Al-Qaeda to establish a foothold in the Islamist militant scene again, even if it's much reduced from 2001.
11:05 in Abbottabad. The operation is code green.
But then, 2nd May 2011, there's a raid on a compound in Pakistan. Bin Laden's finally found and killed.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
How profound is that moment for Al-Qaeda?
Losing bin Laden is a massive blow. I mean, not only is he the founder and a kind of mythic figure within the entire Salafi jihadi militant movement, but for Al-Qaeda, he's a pretty effective commander. And obviously the message sent by the fact that he is found and doesn't die in any particularly spectacular way as a martyr, but is basically shot in his pyjamas in his family home, is a major blow to the organisation.
Within a few years of bin Laden's killing, from the battlefields of Iraq and Syria, we see a new kind of terrorist threat emerge in the form of groups like ISIS. For the casual observer, perhaps this is just the continuation of the same threat, but actually this is a kind of evolution in jihad, isn't it?
ISIS is a break-off from Al-Qaeda, and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi explicitly rejects the authority of Al-Qaeda's then leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Al-Zawahiri says to him, what are you doing? You can't do this. I don't want you to do this. Who says you can take over, half of Syria and turning it into the Islamic State? You can't do that. And Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi just says, well, yes, I can. You stop me.
The jihadis, formerly known as ISIS. Today they announced a new name, the Islamic State.
Which is almost unheard of. I mean, he completely repudiates the authority of the head of al-Qaeda and sets up his own organization, which follows a very different strategy, much more sectarian, much more brutal, just so brutal it makes even al-Qaeda look kind of relatively moderate. And they kill a lot of former al-Qaeda people. And so from the rise of the Islamic State, you have a major fracture in the world of Islamic extremists, major moment for al-Qaeda, major challenge for the group.
Coming up, al-Qaeda is hunted around the world and surpassed by a new threat. How do they come back? Jason, you've been telling me this story of an organization that was the victim of its own success in some ways. It loses its base, eventually its leader, and then with the rise of ISIS, it's not even in the media much anymore. At the same time, under most people's radars, it's made an important change that means it's able to survive all these things we've been talking about. What was that shift?
The way al-Zawahiri transforms al-Qaeda has positioned it really well now. And that's because he basically says the far enemy attacks, the attacks on the US, on Western Europe, were a distraction. They weren't necessarily a mistake, but they were a distraction. A better strategy is to build from the ground up. So we're going to go out, we're going to reach out through micro-alliances, through providing governance, and through, above all, not killing other Muslims, to communities in places that are chaotic and anarchic, to communities that feel threatened, and we're going to say to them, we're here to look after you. And through doing that, we can build territory, influence, and reach. And that's what al-Qaeda have done steadily and patiently through the last decade, with considerable success in some parts of the world. They've positioned themselves as the kind of moderate option compared to ISIS. They will have been benefited significantly by the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan, because that's the sort of jihad that they can get along with.
The al-Qaeda terror group has released a statement on the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and this statement conveys the al-Qaeda's congratulatory message to the Taliban.
It's really interesting what you say about this strategy shift that Zawahiri undertakes to kind of more local alliances and trying to win over hearts and minds. And I remember what you said earlier about the al-Qaeda of the late 90s existing at the kind of peak of globalization and having goals that reflected that time. And it seems to me that the al-Qaeda of today, in some ways, also reflects our own times, where there is this backlash away from globalization, from mass media, towards a much more local approach and a much more fractured media environment.
The key to al-Qaeda's survival has been its ability to change with the times. The moment that is the kind of global height of globalization, al-Qaeda are doing these massive, spectacular international attacks. And then 15 years after that, they've almost gone hyper-local. Affiliates and then small groups doing their own thing with the local alliances, even tribal alliances or marital relations with different power brokers locally. This kind of granular stuff is much more of our age.
When you think back to the roots of al-Qaeda in 1988 or the horrors of 9/11, would you have ever imagined that this group would still be operating today, still be a force to be reckoned with?
It's an astonishing thing that they're still here, to be honest. The average terrorist group lasts between 3 and 5 years, depending on how you define the group. Certainly, the number of groups that can continue campaign of this sort of scale and size for decade after decade are really very rare. So, no, I don't think I ever did expect to be talking about Al-Qaeda kind of 20 years after 2001. I was pretty unsure that Al-Qaeda would survive the death of bin Laden in 2011. Pretty unsure that now that Al-Qaeda will survive the death of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is very sick. But then the history shows that anyone who writes off Al-Qaeda now is probably being a bit optimistic.
Ayman, whether groups like Al-Qaeda will be able to take root in Afghanistan again is still an open question. But I'm wondering, if there was a young man today with similar impulses to those you had, do you think his pathway would be similar to yours, drawn to that part of the world to find glory, death, in a holy struggle?
The victory of the Taliban is going to be presented as a significant confirmation of the fact that the jihad is a continuous noble struggle that will continue until the fulfillment of the prophecies. That's what I'm fearing, is that there will be many people who will be migrating, flying from Europe, you know, from North America, from Australia, from the Middle East, from North Africa, you know, in order to go and live under the rule of the Taliban. And this is my fear now.
That was Ayman Dean, a former Al-Qaeda operative turned double agent. These days, he's a business consultant. And thanks also to Jason Burke, nowadays the Africa correspondent for The Guardian. That's all for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design by Axel Carcutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. Back tomorrow.